Teachers, administrators, and other school staff play an important role.
Education can be a shining light, and it's really the equalizer for everybody.
You are making a difference in people's lives, including your students.
You can have a really bad day at school and still realize that what you're doing is making a bigger difference.
We are the best profession in the world next to doctors, but even a doctor had a teacher.
Find what helps at cdcfoundation.org/how right now. A lot is being asked of people working in schools.
Teachers have more and more things to do.
The shortage of teachers right now, having to fill a lot of holes and wear a lot of hats, it's very difficult.
There are steps you can take to manage stressful times, whether in the classroom or outside of work.
For me personally, I can disconnect by just being outside.
Laughing works a lot.
Find what helps at cdcfoundation.org/how right now. A lot is being asked of people working in schools.
Teachers have more and more things to do.
The shortage of teachers right now, having to fill a lot of holes and wear a lot of hats, it's very difficult.
There are steps you can take to manage stressful times, whether in the classroom or outside of work.
For me personally, I can disconnect by just being outside.
Laughing works a lot.
Find what helps at cdcfoundation.org/how right now.
Welcome to the Top Order Podcast. Today in this episode, we're joined by a man who's played over 50 tests and more than 100 ODIs for New Zealand across a 10-year international career. He captained his country, scored 300 in a day, played first-class cricket in South Africa, coached Ireland, and has worked in the betting and racing industries among plenty more interesting experiences. Ken Rutherford, welcome to the Top Order Podcast.
Good evening, guys. How are you this evening?
Oh, look, we're very well and delighted to be here. Look, since you've been kind enough to sit down with us on the podcast, we thought we'd start right back at the start. Was being an international cricketer always the dream that you had when you were growing up?
Probably not, actually. I mean, both my parents came from Aberdeen in Scotland, and, back in the 50s, cricket probably wasn't a sport played often up in the Granite City, but football was, soccer was, and... Having two older brothers who were pretty good at soccer and cricket as well, mind you. But I guess if you'd asked me at 12 or 13 years of age which sport was more likely to take my attention span over the next 10 to 15 years, I probably would have said football. But it wasn't quite the case. And cricket from around, I debuted for Otago when I was 17, wasn't it? So I guess from about 15 or 16, cricket became more of a primary sport to me than soccer.
And, debut at 16, 17 for Otago, and at 19 you find yourself picked for New Zealand to tour the West Indies. I mean, at a tender young age like that, what was going through your mind when you were selected? How did you find out? And had you met anyone in the squad at that point even?
Yeah, I had. I had met a few of the guys. I'd been a substitute fielder a couple of times at Carisbrook and some of the test matches played there in the mid-80s. That very memorable one, actually, in 1984-5 when Pakistan played at Carisbrook. You might remember Lance Cairns got hit in the head by Wazim Akram.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it was Chatfield and Coney must have batted for quite some time to put on about 40 or 50 to win the test match for New Zealand. I was the substitute fielder on that match and was around the dressing room, so I got to meet quite a few of the guys then as a sort of 17, 18-year-old, I suppose. But, I mean, I was, very surprised to get picked to go on that tour in 1985 to the West Indies. Obviously, they were a pretty good side. I'd played all of 8 first-class games, I think, guys, at that stage for Otago, and averaging around 31, and they got one first-class 100. So the experience wasn't there at all, was it, really? But I think, to be fair to Frank Cameron, Don Neely and the other selectors of that side, they probably saw me as a bit of a punt for the future. That I wouldn't get to play too many test matches, if any, on that tour. But the way things panned out, I played all 4 of them.
Yeah, did you think going into that tour that you'd get to play in any of the tests? What were your expectations going to the West Indies for the first time as a 19-year-old?
Well, oddly enough, because I'd been reasonably successful through my sort of school days and age group level and to play for Otago was going okay. I kind of, I guess, had this naivety about me, which I thought look, it's just a red ball coming down. It might be a bit quicker and it might be a foreign country, et cetera, but I should still go okay because I've gone okay pretty much all the way through to date, to those 19 years. But clearly that was completely wrong. It didn't take me long, I don't think, to work that out. Probably one test match, bagging the pair in the first test match. I always say to people who ask me, guys, that the worst thing I did, I think, was to score 100, my second first-class 100 against a West Indies under-23 team at St Kitts the game before the test match. That kind of gave me that pushed my claims to be selected in the test side. And it was probably the worst thing I did.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to the on-field stuff in a second, but can you talk to us about kind of what cricket was, you know, international cricket, I suppose, was like in 1984-85? I mean, you know, what was the, I mean, you know, no disrespect, but we're not on ships and anything like that. It's not that far back, but I'm sure that, you know, the actual travel conditions and the facilities and everything was completely different to how it is for the guys and girls today.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I remember, as an example, we used to meet at the Travelodge Hotel at the Auckland Airport, meet in the foyer there in the house bar there. Yeah. And Graham Dowling, who was the then CEO of New Zealand Cricket, would turn up with one contract. Yeah. And everyone would be asked to read the contract. It was about 30 pages long, so, you know, I wouldn't necessarily read most of it. And in the back page was a place for everyone to sign it, the whole team, to sign one page. And it was sort of a going joke at the time, guys, if as long as Richard Hadley signed the back page, we're all in, because he was obviously the key player. If we went without Paddles, we had no chance of winning. So everyone used to give Paddles the contract first and say, Richard, you read this and you sign it. If you haven't signed it, we're all going to sign it. So that was the way it was done. And getting to West Indies, I remember the plane trip. You went through LA to Miami, through to, I think, the first game was in Kingston, Jamaica, and, you know, it took about 50 hours probably to get there. There was no overnights. We just, you know, we slummed it, I guess, in transit lounges on the way through to Kingston, Jamaica, and then turned up there and went for 2.5 months and played all the lead-up games. Of course, these days they don't play any lead-up games, do they? Just go straight into test matches, ODIs or T20s, and with big squads of players nowadays. I mean, I just read today the Australian squad's been picked to go to the West Indies to play white ball over there. I think it's about 30 in it. So, yeah. And back then, the West Indies tour would have only been sort of 14 or 15. So the whole resourcing, the whole professionalism was completely different to what it is today.
And you know, so you are selected for those tests, and I guess it's been well documented. Things didn't go especially well for you in those four games. But, I mean, you know, how scary was that West Indies attack? I mean, you were up against Malcolm Marshall, Michael Holding, Joel Garner. You said you'd played eight first-class games. I mean, there's not much of a tougher introduction to international cricket at that point, surely.
No, probably not. I mean, when you think about the great teams of the history of the game, really, going back all those years to W.G. Grace and others back in the late 1800s. I mean, the West Indies side of the 80s is probably one which ranks in the top two or three in terms of the all-time great size. I'm sure there's a couple of recent Australian sides, or maybe not recent Australian sides, but Australian sides with Gilchrist and Warne, et cetera, and Ponting who would rank up there as well. But you're talking Haynes, you're talking Grinnings, you're talking Gomes. Mm. Then you're talking Viv Richards, Richie Richardson, Gus Logie, Jeff Dujon. Then you got your bowlers, Malcolm Marshall, Joel Garner, Michael Holding, Courtney Walsh, Patrick Patterson, Winston Davis, etc. So it was a formidable lineup. I think if you look at that series we played against them in 85, the most remarkable thing about it was, in a way, that we only lost 2-0. We drew the first two test matches at Port of Spain and Trinidad and at Georgetown, Guyana, the border oval in Georgetown, and then got on a very quick wicket at Barbados and got thrashed, and then on another very quick wicket at Sabina Park and actually put on a pretty good match, to be fair, but still went under to the West Indies there. So to lose 2-0 in a four-match series against the Windies in those days actually was a fairly credible performance by the side.
And how are things for you, like being that young during the tour? I guess you're struggling on the field, and nowadays there'd be a lot of support staff and all that kind of stuff. But I imagine it was just maybe coach, manager, maybe not even a physio. Then, what was the the atmosphere like in the camp? And did you get support from the players? Did you get support from the coaching staff?
There was rum. You know, one thing about the West Indies is there's rum.
Yeah.
And fortunately, it was rum, actually. But no, of course, I'm being flippant. But no, the guys were excellent. I mean, you know, John Wright talks about it now when we're having a couple of beers and talking about the days we used to spend down at the pool after a day's play and just talking about general life stuff. Johnny Bracewell and all the guys, really. I mean, Chats, Lance Cairns, etc. It was, I think everyone understood it was a almost impossible assignment for an opening batsman of good experience, but for an opening batsman of no experience, such as I was, and of youth as well, was going to be extremely tough. So I think, you know, without, you know, pandering to me and being overly patronising towards me, they sensed that it was pretty tough. But, yeah, at the end of the day, as Roddy said to me once, he said, mate, you're always going to go through a tough spell in your test career. Hopefully you're going to have a long one. You just got rid of yours in the first series.
Yeah, ideally. And, I mean, you so after... after that tour, you did get dropped from the New Zealand side. How were the scars there? I mean, how tough was it to make it back to international cricket after that?
Yeah, I guess they were. I mean, I sort of look back at, you know, I was 19, so I'm 54 now. So it's like a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
It pretty much is, isn't it? So I can't recall exactly how I felt. I guess I still had that kind of naive, youthful ignorance. That's a good word to use, and I think it was probably very apt of me in those days that, oh, things will be okay. You know, I guess a bit of a Kiwi, she'll be right attitude to things. We'll get it right. We'll be fine. And instead of coming back to New Zealand after that tour finished mid-May 1985, I got a contract. I'd had a contract to play Yorkshire League cricket for Hull. Mm. Of course, in those days, Hull, and still is now, is a big rugby league town, and very little cricket was played there apart from just that Yorkshire League side. And even though they're part of Yorkshire, which has a great affinity with the game, it wasn't really a cricket town. I think that really helped and that I could go over there, play once or twice a week in the leagues, but just sort of, you know, just live a pretty normal life and relative anonymity from everyone else. I think if I'd gone back to New Zealand in the middle of May 1985, everyone would have been, once again, wondering how I was, which was probably the last thing I needed. I needed just to get back on the horse, back on the bike and play a bit of cricket again. I think that really helped.
Yeah, and of course you did make it back to the international scene. A couple of years later, you scored 300 runs in two sessions during a tour match in England. And that's, you know, an outstanding effort to get, you know, 100 in a session, let alone 300 in two sessions. But our researchers really wanted to know if you can share any stories about the night before, allegedly a birthday party of a young Willie Watson turning 21. Is there any recollection that you can share with us?
The recollections are greying and dimming by the years, guys, but your informants are accurate. I was telling a story to a mate of mine the other day, actually, and I suggested there might have been about 20 beers involved the night before. He said, Rudd's, knowing you, that it must have been close to 30. I do recall having a few flaming Galliano's or Zambuquas or something at about 4 o'clock in the morning prior to that 300, but I shouldn't be saying that, should I? But no, it was, it's all true. I remember nicking my second ball, I thought just in front of Jeff Boycott at first slip. And he kind of claimed it, and I thought, oh, that's okay, because I wasn't feeling too flash. I thought, you know, duck in my last innings in the UK in 1986, that's right. You know, it was still a first-class game, but nevertheless, and I started walking off, and Boyks owned up to the fact that it might have bounced, and I went, oh, are you sure, Jeff? And he said, yeah, Rudds, I think you've got to hang around. I said, okay, mate. And then Franklin Stevenson, the West Indian, bowled me a nice juicy half-volley out, so I stumbled away for four. I thought, oh, that feels a bit better. I got 100 before lunch, and I got 199 in the middle session. Jesus. So, yeah, things went okay that day. The funniest thing about that innings, though, guys, was Captain Jeremy Coney, who had been extensive in the Willie Watson celebrations the night before as well. He'd got out for a four or five, I think, in the first session and had slept the middle session. And I came off at tea time, 303 not out, I think it was, and John Wright, he was slapping me on the back and braces and the boys, and woke Jeremy up because he'd slept. And he turned to me, looked up, I was on my pads and a bit sweaty and perspiring. And he said, "Gee, Rudge, are you still batting?" I said, "Yeah, I am." He said, "You must be on about 170 by now." And I said, "No, I'm on 303, Jeremy." He just started laughing, joking, thought I was having him on. And Roddy said, have a look at the scoreboard, Captain. So that was the funniest thing.
Brilliant. I mean, we touched on your tough start to a test career. And so what was that feeling like when you did get that first test 100? Was that when you started to think, okay, I kind of belong at this level, I deserve to be here?
That was just pure relief, quite frankly. And I give all credit to Captain John Wright for batting on in that game. I mean, I think it was, if you look in the annals of test match draws, that game, the base reserve between England and New Zealand was probably one of the worst or most boring draws anyway on a very, very flat wicket. I think we batted for 2.5 days, had a scoring rate of about 2.27, and they did the same. And quite frankly, I couldn't get a few runs on that pitch. There weren't a few questions asked. I think it was my 14th test, so, you know, for a top to middle order player, that was just too many. But, yeah, that was relief. It was relief. It was I was 91 or 92 not out overnight, so I can tell you, with great certainty, the Terrace Regency Hotel in the old days up in the Terrace in Wellington, I was fair shit myself most of the night, didn't sleep much. But got those 8 or 9 runs the next day. I remember, I think, working David Capel, the Northamptonshire seamer, down to third man for a single to get my 100 and wave to the crowd. I think the crowd actually shared my feeling of relief. It was a celebration for sure, absolutely, but a sense that jeepers, it's a few test matches it's taken a few test matches too long.
And we'll probably jump around a bit, and we'll move to the 92, because I mean, I think for us here on the podcast, it's sort of one of our special memories from when we were growing up, you know, starting to watch the game and fall in love with the game. I mean, even speaking as a New Zealander, even with the way it ended, it feels like when everyone looks back at it, it's a special time for cricket in New Zealand. But did you guys, when you were starting that tournament, did you guys have any confidence at all? Because the results hadn't gone especially well beforehand.
Well, from a personal perspective, we played a series against England leading up to that World Cup in 92. I think it was a 5-match series or 4-match series. I'd been left out the first two games. So they only picked the squad, the final 40-man squad for the World Cup, halfway through that England series. So I've been left out, so I wasn't even going to be in the World Cup squad. And the team had lost the first two games badly, and there was a bit of an odd scored runs for Otago, so there was a bit of a clamouring to get Rudd's back in the side, which I had no certainty that I was even going to be in the World Cup side. So, and this was literally only, you know, 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks before the World Cup started with our, well, the game in South Africa wasn't against Australia, at the SCG, and then our first match at Eden Park, not so long after that. But so personally, I wasn't expecting to be there. Yeah. But once I was back in the side and we kept losing to England, it's fair to say there was no expectation at all. And what people sometimes fail to realise is that the attendance of that first game we played against Australia, guys at Eden Park, less than 20,000 people there. It was hardly full. And it was a sense of, you know, desperation. I mean, this team hasn't played well. We're playing against an Australian side who were the reigning world champions, having won the tournament in India five years prior, who are a side who swept all before them under Alan Border's captaincy recently. And you just went down their lineup and you just thought, jeepers, we've got no chance. So did we rate ourselves? We thought, we hoped, I guess, that the home advantage would have some kind of bearing. But jeepers, you know, if you're setting a book, as you would these days, in terms of you know, analysing the odds of a team leading into a major competition, we would have been 25-33-1 best.
Yeah. And I mean, we've talked to Deepak Patel in an earlier podcast, and he talked to us about how the team made like a real point of trying to kind of get one over on the opposition. That he talked about it. He told us a story about when he was driving the minibus to the ground, and he cut off Dean Jones in their minibus on the way to Eden Park, and turned around to Wally Lees and said, you know, there's one for me, and talked about how Mark Greatbatch was staring down the Aussies during the anthems. Did you manage to get any mental wins against any of the opposite numbers?
Well, I actually I got on and get on with quite a few of those Aussies quite well. So I think if I tried to steer them down, as I tried to steer Mark Waugh down on that particular occasion, he would just laugh. So for me, that was probably a loss. But Dedek is right, and it probably comes from, you know, having spent some time with Warren, as he was my first ever club captain back when I was 15 years of age, the Dunedin Cricket Club in Dunedin at Tonga Park. And then he was my first Otago captain when I was 17, playing first class cricket against Auckland at the Carisbrook in 1982-83. And then he became my coach for New Zealand. And the one thing that Leasy was very good at, and probably still is the fact that a team is only as good as, the cliche says, the sum of all its parts. And he was big on that. And I know that he believed that with that New Zealand side in 1992, that it wasn't just about a Martin Crowe, although he was very, very important and was very important in that tournament. But he needed to get other guys around Crowe performing. And prior to the World Cup, they weren't. So he coerced them. He got a Mark Rapach smashing at the top of the order. He got Deepak Patel with a new ball. He got myself scoring a few runs in the middle order. He got Danny Morrison doing a good job with new ball at times as well. Chris Cairns actually did a fair job. Everyone, Andrew Jones, obviously. I'll go right through the whole Smithy. I mean, everyone performed at some one given time. Chris House would throw down the stumps. Gavin Larson did what Gavin Larson always used to do in those days, which was very consistent. So, and Leasy was very good at just saying to guys, you know, not even saying to guys, but sort of just having that knowledge, that sort of instinctiveness as a coach, that intuitiveness as a coach, to work with the guys to say, right, we just need you to, you know, to get your 90s or your 95% out of yourselves and we'll be okay here. And he did that. But the catalyst was obviously beating Australia in that first game. If we hadn't beaten Australia in that first game at Eden Park, I don't think we would have got even close.
Yeah, that's funny you mentioned that the crowd wasn't that good, because I you know, a highlights video that I used to watch of the tournament, and I remember it quite, you know, well, and you always, they always cut to these footage of the crowd and everyone's cheering. Yep. And I think if you talk to people, that everyone will tell you that they were at that game and at the semi, although obviously you know, we got on such a roll in that tournament later.
They were definitely at the semi. Yeah. But that first game, if you look hard at the back of the stands, and you know, TV plays tricks on you, doesn't it, in terms of they pick up the heavily populated areas in the crowd. And there was just a sense of apathy, really, after our series against England before that 92 World Cup. But I think the overall, when you look at that 92 World Cup in terms of a ICC-organised tournament, it was probably the best one we've ever had, you know. Yeah. You had the teams that deserved to be there. They played each themselves once. You truly found the best four teams to go to the semi-finals. Mm. And then, as we know, anything can happen in the semi-final of the World Cup.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, did you guys get swept up in all that atmosphere? And, I mean, you know, so at halfway point of that semi-final, I mean, are you guys starting to think about the final?
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember it vividly. Yeah. I remember Rod Latham coming at me at half time with a big smile on his face and saying something like, "Ruds, we're nearly there. Can you believe we're going to play a World Cup?" Not exact words to that effect, but words to that effect, if you know what I mean. And honestly, I felt the same. What did we get? 260 odd, 270? Yeah, yeah. You'll know more than I do about the exact score.
Which was a massive score then, wasn't it?
Which in those days, Eden Park, as you well know, I mean, there was, you know, a lot of runs. We were swept away with it. And I don't know, a lot's been said about what happened in those 50 overs hence. And I'm not going to make too much of a comment other than to say, in a game of sport, one team sometimes plays a little better than the other, and sometimes certain individuals play some innings which are you know, hard to decipher, hard to, you know, categorise in terms of what you expect. And I think Nzamamo Hark did that day.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, you know, you could see it on the, you know, there's so much footage of all the guys in tears afterwards and things. I mean, you know, was that the most crushing loss of your career? I mean, I feel like it seemed that way at the time, even for us fans.
Yeah, it probably was. Yeah, no, well, obviously it was. I mean, I don't dwell on it too much, actually, because, I mean, I just think you've I'm a bit simplistic about these sort of things, guys. I kind of think it is sport, it is a game at the end of the day, and it is very simplistic. So you do your best, you try your best, and sometimes that's not quite good enough. But if you look yourself in the mirror, that's a horrible cliche, isn't it? But and say you've actually done as well as you can, then you haven't got too many comebacks. And I know as a fact that over the course of those 2.5 months of or 2 months of playing that tournament, we did as well as we could have. I think that previous game we played against Pakistan at Christchurch had a bit of a bearing on it. And they had been our nemesis side for a few years with Yunus and Akram and guys like that, and me and Dad Imran and other guys. So a very talented side. And there's always a sense in a one-off game like a semi-final that we're going to do something mercurial. And I kind of quite quickly came to the realisation that it was mercurial. That's just Pakistan. They've done it to us before. They'll probably do it to us again with those quality of players. And, you know, I think if you'd asked me who's the best batsman that I've ever seen, there were probably three guys I'd probably say. Martin Crowe would be one. Alan Border would probably the second one, but probably top of the polls, Java Meyndad. And the way Meyndad, if you go back and look at that last 2 hours of that match, ball by ball in real time, and just find a recording of it, the way Meyndad kept his whole side, you know, the guy at the other end, his partner, under control in a red-hot, white lightning situation. You know, Inzamam was, what, 18 or 19 years of age?
He is young, yeah.
Meyndad was down there every ball, talking to him, controlling him, you know, massaging the guy, composing the guy. And I've seen Meyndad do that so many times. He was just a genius, that guy. And probably in terms of the plethora of great players that we've seen in the 80s and 90s as batsmen with great records, he was a guy probably, in my opinion anyway, gets underrated.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, post the 92 World Cup, a few senior players from that New Zealand side moved on, and you found yourself as captain in a test, and again, this time against Pakistan. Was captaincy in that leadership role something that you strived for? Was it something you ever aimed for? When did it come? When it came along, what was it like from taking over from Martin Crowe?
Gee, lots of questions there. Well, taking over from Crowe was difficult because he was very, very good. In fact, when you talk about losses that irk, that was probably a loss that irks in a way more than that semi-final when we lost to Hamilton that day against Pakistan. But no, I never really had much expectation of captain New Zealand. Now, I grew up as, you know, a good player through age group levels from under, you know, 12, 14, 16, 18, like a lot of young good players do. And because you're the best young player and you're a batsman, you get given the captaincy. But I never really had aspirations to take over from Crowe. But that game at Seddon Park in about, what, 93, we should have won that. I think we're chasing 130 the fourth innings on a good deck. We went into the fifth day, or it might have been the fourth day actually, we were three down or four down. The turning point there was Andrew Jones. I mean, nothing to do with Jones himself, but he absolutely smashed one straight to short point and he caught it off Yunus. And that was a turning point. Even another 20 runs of Jonesy that day, we would have won that game, I'm sure of it. But Jonesy got out there unluckily, and I got out playing a pretty poor shot, driving wide at Akram. And things just, the Donomo effect was often the case when you face Yunus and Akram occurred. It was so hard to go out there fresh to face those guys. And, you know, it's just a game we probably should have won, and I'm sure everyone on that team reflects on that. But my first test match, 0-1.
You did manage to get your own back against Pakistan, though. You chased down over 300 to win, which was your first win as captain. That was a huge effort then to chase down 300 in those kind of conditions in New Zealand. That must have felt pretty good to get one on the board, though.
Yeah, the old Lancaster Park, and that wicket, you know, often got better and better as the game went on. That was the case in that test match. And Brian Young, I believe, got a few guys. Shane Thompson certainly got runs, and I'm pretty sure Tony Blaine took us home. So, you know, I kept on New Zealand 18 tests, two victories. That was the first one, and the second one was the Wanderers in 1994. It was a good one, a very good one. And any time you beat Pakistan is good because they're a very good side.
And look, I guess one thing maybe is taking a little step back. It seemed like in that 92 World Cup, there was such – it's certainly from the outside, it seemed like there was such a good vibe in the actual squad – But then it never really felt like we had that again for a few years. I guess as a fan watching on, did the events in Sri Lanka in 92, like, was that what sort of broke down all that stuff?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, and I sense that you've taken time, and you know, it's not an easy question to ask. I've no doubt about that. I've got no doubt at all that the events in Sri Lanka that day severed some relationships in the side. Mm. It was a difficult time, and it's funny when you talk to people subsequent to that event that. What I say to them is you can't comprehend the extent of it or what you'd do in that particular case when you're given the options at hand. And I don't know, you look back and you might say there's regrets there from a personal perspective, from my side, or from a team perspective, all for one for all kind of thing. We all should have gone home, or we should all try to stay. I don't know. There's no right or wrong in that. But I certainly know that From the folk that went home to some of the folk that they knew well who stayed, that some of the relationships were tainted, and I'm sure that that is still felt to this day by some.
Mm. Oh, look, I mean, I think it's tough for all of you guys just to have gone through that. To be quite honest, I think for anyone who's listening doesn't really know, you know, it was a bomb blast in Sri Lanka, and you guys were very close to the ground level of it all happening. So. Yeah, guys can go and do their own research on that. But, yeah, very, very tough times. Look,
well, I did get a second test 100 by staying, so it wasn't a bad call from a personal perspective. Yeah. Although I'm saying that flippantly, guys, so don't take it too serious.
No. But nice that there was a silver lining after something so terrible. Look, we'll move to 93-94, the World Series, New Zealand, South Africa, Australia. It's another, I mentioned before, I had a highlights video of the 92 World Cup. This was another video that I just had and played on repeat as a youngster. I don't really know why I loved it so much, because New Zealand wasn't especially successful in that tournament. A few hammerings, but some good wins in there, and it felt like we were kind of the underdogs all the time. A couple of things really struck me watching it again recently. One was how the bats these days, pretty much every miscue in that video, it barely even got to the 30-metre circle, whereas nowadays everything goes for six. And how big some of those grounds were in Australia when the boundaries weren't in.
Yeah.
I
played on a lot of that series. I kept on playing on. I kept on trying to play late cuts to balls, which are middle stump, which clearly isn't it's not a great technique, really. But no, they are big grounds, and you... Your point around bats is actually one which has, I think initially it was mentioned by quite a few, but it's been overlooked lately. And I've got a son, Hamish, who you'll know plays, and I look at his bats, and they pick up the same as my. The only bat I've still got, guys, is the bat I got 317 with at Scarborough. It's the only bat I retained to this day. It's in a chest in the storage in Cambridge, actually. And I won't tell the unit number because it's probably worth a bit of money in a few years' time, or at least enough for a couple of bottles of red wine. But it's really not very wide. It's like narrow, and it's your typical grey nickels from 1986. It's 2 pounds. Was it two pounds of 10 ounces or something like that? Does that sound right?
Yeah.
Hamish's bats weigh the same, and he seems to have about five times more wood on them. And they're like these thick railway pillars of bats, but they pick up beautifully. Mm. And when they get a top end, the top edge, they go for six if you try and hit them hard enough. And there's certainly a relationship there between the the feats, the statistics of a 1985 player to a 2021 player. So there's no doubt that the bats have had some sort of impact in the way careers have ebbed and flowed over the years, shall we say. But going back to 1993-94, did we make the finals in those days? I think we didn't, didn't we?
No, we didn't. I think we had to beat Australia in the last round robin game and lost in that one. Look, I could talk about this.
What was the game when Chris Pringle bowled that last over to Bruce Reid and went very well?
That was a different
2-3.
Yeah, that was a different series.
See, clearly my subliminal memory is about wins rather than losses, guys. So let's try and be positive on the show. Okay?
Yeah, yeah. Look, I do have a couple of specific kind of random questions for you from that 93-94 that I've always wondered about. The first one is you chipped one back to Shane Warne in that series. Just very clear, chipped it straight back to the bowler. But at the time, you claimed bump ball, and he actually got away with it. What I want to know is, did you genuinely believe that it was bump ball at that time, or was that just a brilliant piece of acting?
So who told you? Did you set yourself, or have you heard the story before?
No. I've watched it's a video that I've watched many times.
Well, that's one of my after-dinner little speech notes, actually. That was a complete bit of acting. Robert Redford-like, wasn't it? Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I mean, that was... No, actually, more like The Colour of Money or The Sting. Yeah, probably The Sting, actually. No, that was a complete... I'll tell you what happened. He bowled me a slow full toss like a flipper, a quicker one through the air, and it was about ankle height, and I very much hit it straight back to him when he caught it. But I noticed when he was catching it, he went to his right in his follow-through, and I saw that the umpire was obscured in his view. And I thought, well, the umpire hasn't seen that. And sure enough, and I just hung around, and the umpire hadn't seen it. And so he went to the squealing umpire. But meanwhile, as the umpires were conferring, so the squealing umpire was walking towards the front on umpire, et cetera, you know, as it was happening, they showed on the big screen, the SCG, full house. And everyone could see it. I mean, it was clearly out. And Steve Waugh came from backward point, and Muddy had a full go at me, and Ian Healy was a keeper, he had a full go at me, and Ball was having a full go at me. The whole Australian's having a full go at me. Mark Grabbage was out of the end laughing. Like, hey, I thought, this is very funny. He said, Muds, you should have walked off there. I said, bugger it. No, the umpires, you know, they occasionally get it wrong. So, and Steve Randell was the squealing umpire, and he wasn't really watching. So he couldn't say yes or no. And they weren't allowed to refer to the big screen. They weren't allowed to look at it. Mm. So the umpires had to go, well, we've seen nothing here. So not out.
Brilliant.
And I'll tell you, the only guy who never said anything was Shane Warne. In the next ball, he bowled to the short one outside our stump, and I hit it down to out backward point for one. And I walked past Warnie, and I said, Warnie, the cat got your tongue. I said, you might have been a bit lucky there, mate. He said, Rads, I know if I give you a hard time, they make you try harder. But that's the only compliment I've ever had from an Australian there. Yeah, true story.
Brilliant.
I might have got one away on those guys then, but anyway, it's fair to say they had plenty on us. At times, particularly Australian umpires in Australia.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you heard of Dick French?
Yeah. No, that one. Have you spoke to Brian Young since that tournament, though? Because it seemed like he wasn't really listening to your calls between the wickets in that tournament.
Jeez, I'll tell you what, I'm hardly Ben Johnson between the wickets, am I? I'm more like Billy Bush, the ex-All Black prop. But... a couple of times he was a bit quick for me, old youngie. MCG was at one time, I seem to recall vaguely, but okay.
And just on a more serious note, you mentioned facing Warne before. It was right when he was bursting onto the scene, and from memory, I think you actually personally went all right against him, but he just seemed to have it over most of the guys. Was that purely that we just hadn't seen a leg spinner and faced a leg spinner, or I mean, even at that young age, was he just something so special?
Yeah, I think all those things bear some thought, and you're right on, you know, to some extent on all those things you said. The thing about Warnie was he was so consistent. You know, he was in a way he was the best attacking bowler who was so defensive in his approach, because if you compare him to the likes of Mushtaq Ahmed and others from Pakistan and the subcontinent like Huwani and those guys, their biggest threat was the wrong one and the top spinner. I mean, Warnie's wrong was a shocker. Absolutely, but by self-admission, if you ask Shane Warne about his wrong, it was a shocker. He basically bowled three balls. He bowled a very, very, very good leg spinner. He bowled an average flipper, which occasionally got right, and he bowled a very good top spinner. But he was so consistent. I mean, his leg spinner was – he could land on a dime, and particularly when he bowled around the wicket later on in test matches, you know, days 4 and 5 into the rough, it was very, very difficult to score runs. So – And techniques forever and a day. I mean, these days the worst techniques trying to play spin from around the wicket into rough. They can't play it these days. But even back in 30 years ago, you struggle to play it because it's very hard to play four or five overs of one bowler and look to score no runs. That's difficult. Just the thought about batting is to try and score runs. But as soon as you look to try and play out of the rough, what are you going to do? Your options are very limited. You can't dance down. You can't drive them through the covers. Basically, you're limited to playing to about 60 degrees of the field. So mentally, that's very, very tough. And Warnie knew that. And because you're so consistent, you didn't bowl long hops, you didn't bowl many full tosses, only a few. He just had you down that end, over after over, ball after ball, and eventually you'd make a mistake. And that was his modus operandi. And it was a great challenge to play the guy. I mean, he got me out a few times, but, I had a few successes against him as well.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. A legend of the game. Moving on a little bit, the next part of your career kind of intrigues me because we move forward to 94, 95 and New Zealand's tour of South Africa and plenty of things to talk about. But what I wanted to open with is, what was it like to tour South Africa then? I mean, you ended up playing first-class cricket in South Africa later on in your career. What was that tour, that first tour to South Africa like for you?
Well, I remember fifth form history at King's High School in Dunedin. So fifth form, what am I, 15 years of age, 16 years of age. We had a history teacher called Clive Geary, who was, his nickname was Yub, and he'd been in the Second World War. And you talk to anyone around Dunedin old enough to know Yub, and they would say he was the most unluckiest player not to be a double All Black, rugby and cricket, and loved his cricket. And I got in his history class in fifth form, and he said to me, he followed my cricket career even at a young age, and he knew my brother Ian, who was 8 years my older, and had taught Ian as well. And he took a shine to me, quite frankly. Mm. But he taught me about South Africa. And he said, often to me, he said, if there's one, because he'd been over there to watch the All Blacks play and stuff like that and through the 60s and 70s. He said, there's one country you want to go and play cricket in, Ken, and it's South Africa. Mm. And it's a true story. And since then, as a, I guess, impressionable 16-year-old trying to listen to my teacher, who I had a lot of respect for, I thought myself, it's one country I want to go to. And obviously, it was a country that had issues through my initial time, my initial playing career. But when they came back on the scene in the early 90s, I just thought to myself, how good is this going to be? And, enjoyed it.
And in terms of the cricket, people often forget New Zealand won that first test in South Africa, not something that often happened. And reportedly, the aftermatch of that went on for several days. Was that sort of aftermatch celebration just part of cricket tours back then?
Yeah, well, I guess, we finished the game, I think on the fourth day, actually, and we didn't have another game for about a week. So that was part of it, I guess. So I guess when you look back, maybe the captain and the coach and the team management should have shown a bit more restraint with the players in terms of people were disciplined and what we had to do going forward. But it was a strange one, though, because we played the first test match end of November. And then we didn't play the next two test matches to Boxing Day and then New Year's Day in Cape Town. So Boxing Day at Durban. Mm. And between those, in those 4 weeks or 5 weeks between the test matches, we played a one-day series against Sri Lanka and Pakistan as well as South Africa. So it was a funny kind of fixture list, to be frank with you. But no excuse. I mean, yeah, the boys had a good time after that test win, which we probably didn't expect. And got to the second and third test match in Durban and Cape Town, where we're in good positions to win the series, really. I mean, Durban was a desultory test for us. We didn't play well, but certainly in Cape Town, we were very unlucky.
Yeah, and look, I mean, there's been so much written about that tour and the weed incident. I think if anyone doesn't know, they can just go and Google 94-95 South Africa cricket. Weed New Zealand and they'll find whatever they want to read about. But I'm kind of interested in what it's like to kind of manage relationships on a long tour like that. I mean, it must be, you put 15, 20 people all in close quarters for 2 or 3 months. I'm sure it's a tricky thing to manage, particularly as a leader of that group.
Well, you presume they're adults for a start. That's the first presumption. You believe, they can handle their own lives and work around that and control things to an extent. And largely people did during that tour, to be fair, with a first time New Zealand have been to South Africa, and you know, a few things there which we probably could have improved on looking back with the benefit of hindsight. But in saying that, you know, that first Test match win of Wanderers was a great performance by the team. Mm. And as I say, Cape Town, if you look at that Cape Town match, there was a couple of things there which happened. I mean, you complain about umpire decisions and referees' decision in rugby or football or whatever it might be, and you think, well, that's had a bearing on careers and things and legacies. Well, that Cape Town Test match, guys, quite frankly, I've never played a Test match like that before, where there was situations which happened during the game where things just went against us. But anyway, sour grapes.
Oh, no. I mean, what was the fallout for you after that tour? Because you didn't really play too many more games after that, ended up going back to South Africa and played first-class cricket after that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was a personal decision, really. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I think Glenn Turner came in as the coach and he decided he had a different sort of way of looking at things, and you know, it didn't include me, and that's fine. You respect a person of Turner's stature in the game, the fact that he's coming and wants to change things, there's no issue there. And you know, I would have quite liked the fact that, you know, maybe gone to South Africa and played Currie Cup over there for a couple of years or 3 years and come back to New Zealand and maybe had a go for New Zealand again. But the fact of the matter is, fellas, you know, I went to South Africa, I enjoyed it. On a personal level, it was very, very good for me. And on a professional level too, in terms of my cricket, playing for Transvaal, they had a good side, had a number of South African players playing for them. The cricket was of a very good standard when you play Western Province. They had the guys like Desmond Haynes playing. They had McMillan, Matthews, Kirsten, Callis, Gibbs, etc. You played against Natalia, Malcolm Marshall, they had Jonty Rhodes, they had guys like Dale Benkenstein, Tertius Bosch, Sean Pollock, obviously. And all through, you go through Northern Transvaal, Free State, Eastern Province had a great side. A couple of vessels captaining that side, Brett Schultz, Merrick Pringle. Got with Tim Shaw, Dave Callaghan. I mean, they're really good players. So the quality of cricket, even though I wasn't playing Test cricket, was still very, very high. And I was successful there, did well personally, and did well as a team. So it was a really nice 5 years playing for Transvaal.
And then after your sort of playing career finished, you ended up in the coaching ranks for a little while. You end up as coach of the Ireland national side. How did that come about? And maybe can you share a couple of stories of what it's like to coach that Ireland side? I've lived in Belfast. I've watched cricket at Stormont a couple of times while I was living there.
Yes.
What was it like coaching that Ireland side?
Frustrating, because you look at it now and they're obviously, are they a test playing country? I think they are, aren't they?
Yeah, they are a test playing country.
Yeah, played a test last year, didn't they? Against England, I think it was. Mm-hmm. In those days, frustrating, because the main frustration was born by the fact that they weren't allowed, back in those days, any players from outside of Ireland. So you had to be born in Ireland. And when you're playing in the same kind of group of countries like Holland, Denmark, Scotland, Canada, America, where you had all these naturalised folk from South Africa or the West Indies or from other cricket-playing nations, which obviously gave those countries a real step up. It was a sense of frustration, but since they've changed that, they had guys like Trent Johnson come through and other guys initially. We had a guy who played club cricket in Dublin when I was there. I'm just trying to think of his name. Jeremy was his first name. Pete Bates for New South Wales had gone over to Dublin and lived over there and couldn't get in the Irish team because he wasn't naturalised. So that was a certain frustration, but nowadays, Irish cricket is very strong, obviously, and the great thing for me was going, as you said, to Belfast and to go around some of the club grounds. I mean, they were terrific little grounds. To go up to Derry, to Londonderry, and see some of the grounds there in terms of the following they had and some of the uniqueness of the grounds there. Some of them were literally 45-metre boundaries and 80-metre boundaries down a hillside on the other side. I mean, it was just incredible how the sport of cricket had evolved in places like that, which was unique, and nothing wrong with that. Going down to Cork and seeing how cricket was down there. So it was a real eye-opener for me, but I think it probably told me at the same time that coaching wasn't really for me. It was probably time that I looked at something else other than cricket in terms of where I wanted to go in my career.
Mm. And just before we move on to some of the things that you've done in your post-cricket career, I have a story from one of the co-hosts of the show who was touring with an MCC side, I think, or might have been his club side, in 2002-2003, played a couple of games against the side in Ireland, and very famously, the Irish side was very hospitable and took them out on the town the night before the game in Belfast and thoroughly gave his side a touch-up on game day. Was that something that was part of the pre-game hospitality for that Irish side to make sure that visiting teams got the best of life in Belfast or Dublin or wherever he happened to play them?
Yeah, I think it was very much on the agenda, no doubt about that. no, it was a good part of the world, obviously. I mean, it was a terrific part of the world and some real characters. I mean, it's just guys there. Every club you went to, as you'd appreciate yourself, being to Belfast and going and playing club cricket over there or going a few grounds over there, they all had these characters in their club rooms, and guys have been there for 20, 30 years. Their families have been there prior and still there now probably. And, you know, the O'Briens is a great example. I think it's the Railway Club in Dublin. I mean, they've been there for years and years and years. Yeah, Noel and Kevin, the latest. But there'll be O'Briens the next 30, 40 years probably out of that club. So... That's what cricket's all about, and those smaller countries where cricket isn't quite the fabric of the community, they need to have that connection with the community.
And you touched there on moving into something outside of cricket. I mean, you're now involved in the racing industry. You've had quite a few roles in the betting industry. Rumours are you've always enjoyed a punt, and I don't mind a punt myself. And you hear those legendary stories about guys like Mark Waugh who reportedly got out on purpose so he could watch a race. Do you have anything like that you can share from your playing days?
No, not quite. I know Mark pretty well. I speak to him pretty much every week or text every week. So
yeah,
I'll be surprised if he did that actually. But the only time I ever went off the pitch to watch a race was Transvaal at the Wanderers, Johannesburg. Forget who we're playing. It was the middle of the session. We were fielding. I was captain, so that's not very good to admit to. Jimmy Cook was our coach, and he was pretty keen on the punt as well. And we had a really nice horse we were following in the next race at Cape Town. So I said to Jimmy, look, well, I think my hamstring is going to have a little problem about 3:33 p.m., mate. And he said, Rudds, I know what you're saying. He said, I'll make sure the TV's on the racing channel. So about 3:31 p.m. I had a slightly pulled hamstring, and Cyril Mitchley, who was the umpire, he was a bit deaf actually, Cyril, so I had to go up quite close to him and tell him. But he also loved the horses too, Cyril. In fact, he used to get the same bookies as I on an off day. He said, Rudds, you're not going up to watch that race from Cape Town, are you? And I said, yes, I am, Cyril. He said, well, make sure you tell me who wins. So I went up and watched the race with Cookie. And we did no good. We did no good at all, actually.
Oh, no.
And about 3:37 p.m., I was back on the field. So I missed about two overs. Yeah. And Mitch wasn't very happy because we backed the same horse. But that's the only time. It's the only time. And most of my mates would be surprised by that. But it's the only time I've got off the field to watch a race. In the old days, before internet betting and phone betting, all that sort of stuff, I used to, you know, in the old club days of playing with the Dunedin Cricket Club at Tonga Park. Mm. You'd take your trebles and your winning places and your doubles for the whole day at 10 o'clock in the morning at the St Kilda TAB in Young Street, South Dunedin, and you play your cricket, and then you go, you literally go at night time when it's still open and put your tickets through the machine and hope like hell you've actually won something. Yeah, and you wouldn't be recording it or watching it live or anything like that. So how things have changed, eh?
Yeah. Look, on a more serious note, many years ago you were encouraging the ICC to partner with betting agencies to stop match fixing. I found a quote you said, at my old job at Singapore Pools, we often heard things in advance from our network of spies. It was something that was suspected in football. The match officials would warn players prior to the game that the match was suspected of being fixed and they'd better not try anything. There's plenty to unpack about that quote. I mean, obviously not expecting you to name any specific events, but like, is that what would happen? And I guess, is there like something in the system that you'd get bets on, you know, a first try score or whatever it is, and something triggers in your system and then sort of everything unpacks from there? How does it all work as a betting agency?
Yeah, well, in Singapore, it was really interesting. I mean, I went over there having been the head of sports betting at the TAB in Wellington, and the big thing about Singapore is their turnover. Their turnover is very, very strong. I mean, their sales, the amount of bets that they produce. And the key for them, in terms of their local competition over there, guys, isn't just Singapore football, but it's pretty much Southeast Asian football. The integrity of the competition's key, because obviously if you, as a Joe Bloggs punter, don't believe the competition is integrous, then you're not going to have a bet. If you know that the results are preconceived, then you're not going to have a bet. So it was continually a conversation I used to have with my boss in terms of I kind of knew certain games were fixed, but at the same time, you had to protect the integrity of the competition. And there's a couple of instances, which I won't go into, which were fairly obvious that things weren't the case. But I guess the point I was making around cricket, and cricket's different. Well, it's similar and it's different, is that what you see is legalised betting on the sports, whether it be football through Southeast Asia or cricket in somewhere like India. The legalised aspect too, well, there's nothing in India that's legalised, but in Southeast Asia, the legalised aspect of football betting is minuscule. You know, Hong Kong Jockey Club do it. The Singapore Pools do it. There's a couple of others who might do it. But the informal or the illegal aspect to it is absolutely ginormous. And there's an opportunity there in India, even to get 5 or 10% of that revenue to try and legalise and do it through basic, you know, community means, where it's going to, as Hong Kong does through their jockey club there and Singapore does through the pools and through the turf club in Singapore, to put it back into community projects. No different, I guess, to what happens in New Zealand with poking money. It goes back into community sport, but on a potentially a lot larger scale in somewhere like India or Hong Kong or Singapore. So that's simply the point I was making, is that the black market is always going to be there in sports betting. You might as well get a share of it by legalising some of it.
And that campaign to sort of partner ICC and the sports betting agencies to help combat match fixing, I mean, it's still that combating match fixing is still something we're going through now, and when we're seeing lots of things come up almost year by year. Did the ICC get any traction on that process? Do you think they've made strides in the last 4 or 5 years in being able to combat match fixing by the way they handle their relationship with betting agencies?
I wouldn't have thought so, but I think what's happened, and you've got to, as I said, as I might have inferred, you've got to differentiate what is a betting agency and what is illegal. And there's a huge illegal black market operation occurring, which, you know, I can't even describe how it works. I mean, I understand in Singapore terms, this is 15 years ago now, how it worked, but it's obviously changed and matured from now. But the whole betting market, though, in terms of, you know, through all sports, tennis was one of the worst back when I was bookmaking, but other sports as well, I'm sure, are the same. It's not necessarily around the result of the game. That's why it's so hard to police. Mm. It's around individual events in a game, whether it be I'm just making this up for the sake of description, but a forward pass in the 21st minute in a game of rugby or a crooked line out. I'm not saying that happens at all. I'm not saying it happens. You know, a wide in cricket in a certain ball, as you saw, or no ball with the Pakistani that time at Lords. The ability for the malcontents in terms of the black market and the betting market to come up with new things which aren't that hard to, you know, legislate against, which are very hard to legislate against, but aren't that hard for people to bet on. It's almost endless, isn't it? So, and that's what's happening now. So I'm not at all going to criticise the ICC or any other governing body of sport because it's just so tough.
Yeah, very, very, very difficult.
Yeah. Look, it seems like such a complex issue, and it's a fascinating one to talk about. Look, you've been so generous with your time. What we often like to do in the podcast is kind of finish up with a few sort of, you know, favourite questions. I will give you a heads up that one of them is the best sledge you've ever been involved in. So we'll get to that one a little bit later and give you a bit of time to think about that one. But to start with, what's the favourite innings you've ever played? Is it that 300 or is there something else that sticks in the memory?
Don't know. I haven't given a lot of thought. Let me have a think. I played well for Transvaal on a couple of occasions on difficult pitches. The Wanderers were green and bouncy, and I thought, you know, getting 70 or 80 there was actually as hard as getting a bigger total somewhere else. It certainly wasn't the 300. The 300 was a bit of a hidden hope, really. I don't know. Let me even think about that. We'll continue on. Next question.
All right. We'll come back to that. You took a test wicket, I saw, in your stats. Who was it? And what was the celebration like?
Mooted. The celebration was very mooted. It was Larry Gomes at Border Oval in Guyana. And we were through the middle of a very, very long hot day in sun. And you and Chatfield have bowled at least 15 overs on the trot. And I came on to bowl some very, very average right arm medium pace. And Jeff Howes said to me, whatever you do at Larry Gomes, Rudds, don't bowl on his legs. So I bowled him a full toss knee high on leg stump and hit straight to middle wicket. And John Bracewell, the substitute fielder, took the catch. And it was my first or second over in Test cricket. And at that stage, I probably had more wickets than runs, quite frankly. I think I might have done. And you know, the only guy who didn't celebrate with me was Ewan Chatfield, who stayed out at final leg with his, you know, that white hat he used to have, that funny white hat, that floppy white hat. He pulled it down even further over his head so you couldn't see his brows. But he was so pissed off. He'd bowl those 15 overs in 35 degrees heat, 100% humidity, with no to no avail. And I bowled this juicy full toss and hit it straight into the wicket. So there you go.
You're talking to two spinners in the room, and we know all about getting wickets with full tosses, so you don't worry about that. What was your most enjoyable win?
I'll tell you what it was. It was in Bombay in 1988. We won a test match there. Hadley was incredible. Andrew Jones played one of the great innings of a New Zealand batsman of all time. I think he got 70 or 80 in the second innings on a pitch, guys, which was just exploding off a length. I got no runs. It was just full houses every day at the Wandika, is it? Stadium in Bombay. It's called Bombay in those days. Yeah. And that was a really memorable one. I mean, Wanderers in 94 was memorable, but and through no personal performance of my own, Hadley was incredible that day, those 5 days. Bracewell bowled really well. Smithy kept incredibly well. And we came off that test match in Bangalore. We were all sick. The first test match of that series, so the Bombay test was the second test. And to win that one was, I think, it'd be pretty hard to beat.
Nice. And your favourite teammate along the way?
Oh, Blaney was good. Blaney's been good fun. Jonesy's been good. Neil McKenzie was a lot of fun at Wanderers. Oh, yeah. He was a lot of fun. No, I've had a lot. I'd hate to sort of earmark one in particular. Righty was obviously very good to me, and I think Kiwis back in the 80s in particular and early 90s, you can't really say there's anyone bad. There wasn't anyone bad. You always got along, and you're all there for the right reasons. You're there collectively. So, but get on pretty well, Blaney. I think he's somewhere in Yorkshire at the moment.
Oh yeah. That your answer kind of ruins my next question, which was who's the most annoying?
Well, McKenzie was pretty annoying at Transvaal because he had and Pothos as well, a guy called Nick Pothos, played over to South Africa. They had all these stupid bloody habits where they had their shoes had to be, everything had to be set out the right way. They had this pattern. They'd be like rough on it all watching him play tennis. He's got to walk in the white lines and all that. He's doing it hidden. So I remember one day the Wanderers McKenzie on about 150 during the latter part of the day's play, and it was going along all right. And so I went up to his place opposite me in the dressing room and just put everything, completely in disarray. He was 180 not out of the stumps, and he came and he said, "Rudds, that was you, wasn't it?" And I said, "Yeah, just goes to prove you don't have to have all this bloody shit the same bloody, beautifully patterned out all the time, mate. Routines are shit. So anyway, but no, he was a good guy.
Yeah, there's a story about him with the taping his bat to the roof, isn't there? I think. Did you ever
see
that?
That was that day. I've seen him do that. Yeah. No, it's totally bizarre. I'd say Nick Potters was the same. He was a really unlucky guy, that guy, not to play more for South Africa, Nick Potters, when Mark Boucher was around his keeper. He's a hell of a player. Mm. I think he's coaching Middlesex or something at the moment. But McKenzie's an outstanding player. But there'd be a few guys I've seen who could play the short ball any better.
Nice. And we've come to that time. The best sledge that you've been involved in or heard on the cricket field?
Well, the best sledge, it doesn't involve me really. I mean, it involves the guy, Kussie Fenter from Orange Free State, when was a story of the Australians tour there in 1993 where he was blocking and blocking and blocking on the flattest track in the world of Bloemfontein. And Healy and Warren, Burnie was at short leg and Warnie was bowling ball after ball after ball, and they couldn't get me out of his crease. And I think it was Healy said to Warnie, he said, "Why don't you put a Mars bar on the length or something like that?" And Warnie said, "No, Burnie will get it."
Brilliant. Oh, nice.
And, yeah.
And look, let's finish up the podcast with what was your proudest moment when you look back at your playing days?
I've had a few. I mean, you hear some people say, "Oh, I don't really think about much." And, I've got to be honest, I don't. I did a podcast on this about 3 days ago, the guy from the UK who was tipped to me by a mutual friend. And this is only the second one I've ever done. Mm. Proudest moment was probably seeing Hamish Rutherford score 171.
Yeah, nice. Nice. Moving on to Hamish, I guess we'll. I know we said we'd finish, but it feels like he's kind of unlucky at the moment because he's in pretty good form, and New Zealand's just got such good stocks in the batting ranks. Does he still sort of harbour ambitions to play for New Zealand?
Oh, I think he does. Yeah. Yeah, I think he does. I think. You know, I think he realises now at 32 years of age that, you know, there's guys there who, you know, the Ravindras who I've seen play, I'm not too sure about him, but anyway, we'll see. Time will tell. Mm. They've been pushed ahead of him by selectors, but yeah, no, he's been unfortunate. I mean, I've seen him play some innings which would rank among the best I've seen, and I'm not just saying it from a father's perspective. I'm sure if you talk to Hamish, you'll know, he'll tell you that I'm as harsh as critic, so I'm not going to be, you know, too mellow and espousing too much over the top well done's. But, you know, there's 171 against England. I mean, that's going to stand the test of time, there's no doubt about that. And,
yeah.
And he's done really well, and he's happy, and he's got a good career. He's going to Glamorgan shortly. And if he gets another chance to play for New Zealand, who knows? I mean, he's the sort of guy who could play till he's 40, so the age is no issue. Let's hope he gets a chance.
Awesome. It's a great way to end the podcast, and it's been a pleasure to chat to you, and you've been really generous with your time. So we'll let you go, and just thanks very much for joining us here on the Top Order Podcast.
Thanks, guys.